Pressure to Assimilate, Lost Heritage, George Floyd Tipping Point. Today on The Pursuit, Faith Brooks. Welcome to The Pursuit, unfiltered conversations with faith leaders about their journey to pursue God. I'm your host, Richard Lee, and today my guest is Faith Brooks. Faith is a master's level social worker, engaging as a social justice advocate and anti-racism educator. She's the director of programs for Be the Bridge, which partners with organizations to respond to the racial brokenness in our world. She's also the co-host of the Melanated Faith podcast and is a gifted speaker, writer, administrator, and consultant. Now, you may have seen her name on Instagram being shared as one of the Black voices that people should really be listening to. So it is my honor to do just that for all of you right now. So Faith, thanks for being here. You have two T's in your first name. Was that at all frustrating growing up, having to correct people?
You know what? I liked it because nobody else was named Faith with two T's.
That's right.
And so that meant that I was, that I knew of, the only Faith with two T's in the world, and I loved it.
You've never met another one?
No, never met another one. Completely unique.
I love it. So where did you grow up?
I grew up in between Chicago, where I was born, and then I moved to Texas when I was about 6 years old, to Dallas, Texas.
Okay.
And then my family moved from Dallas to Houston. And so I lived in Houston from 12 years old and up. So I've moved a lot, actually. So I mean, those two are the major places. And then I've done some more moving around Texas since then.
Yeah. Do you remember Dallas more fondly than Houston, or Houston more fondly than Dallas?
Houston more fondly. Although I went to college outside of the Dallas area, Houston is, that's my city. I love Houston. I found my people there.
A lot more humid in Houston than Dallas.
A lot more humid, but a lot more fun, a lot more good food, and a lot more diversity. So yeah, it's definitely the place that I love.
When you were growing up, were you raised in the church? Like, were you going to church from when you were a kid?
Yes, I was definitely raised in the church. Raised as a church kid, and we spent a lot of time at church growing up as kids. So a lot of our time was spent with our parents, who were very involved, really active in volunteering, or, you know, elders at church, usually in like the hospitality ministry, or sometimes they were in the, you know, kind of like the ministry where you would go and see those in the hospital, like the hospital ministry. So we spent a lot of time going to hospital, seeing people with our parents and visiting, and wherever our parents were, we were. So we were pretty tight-knit as a family.
How about for your own like faith journey? Growing up in the church is one thing, but like your own faith journey with God, your own relationship, what was that journey like for you growing up?
I think for me, I always felt like God was very real to me and was able to develop my own relationship with the Lord. Now, I feel like that evolved as I got older, because when you're younger and you grow up in church, some things kind of feel like an obligation, like, oh, you have to do this, or you have to do that, or you have to do your devotionals this way, or, you know, read this, you know, read this this reflection, and then journal, and then do this. And for my personality type, like, I don't like the boxes or the rules of like, you have to do this and then this and that.
You don't like being told what to do?
No. But I do things that I don't like to do.
Yeah.
So I think you have to be teachable, right? So I learned how to, as an adult, I learned how to be teachable, but also like develop my own relationship with the Lord where it didn't feel forced for me. I think one thing I don't like doing is pretending. And I think I just felt like there's so much you can do in church, and it just feels like you're pretending, and like you're not really being authentic with where you're at and what your life looks like. And I just didn't want, I just didn't want that to be my life. So I wanted to be able to be authentic and real with where I was at and what my life looked like and what my relationship with God looked like. And I finally realized I didn't have to, you know, put on a facade or make it look like everyone else.
Yeah.
It just needed to be important and real to me. And that's really what matters the most.
I feel like that's interesting because I feel like a very common experience of people growing up, not just in the faith, but just adolescence, is, you know, constantly being worried about what other people are thinking. And so there's a lot of quote unquote pretending in terms of, you know, trying to fit in and trying to find out who you are. Where do you feel like you got this sense of the strong sense of self-identity from?
I have incredible parents. And I think they, you know, when we were kids, they would, of course, like model and encourage what they would, you know, want us to see in terms of how we interact with God and pray or prioritize prayer in our lives or, you know, reading your Bible, any of those things. But as we became adults, it was very much so essentially I want you to understand and know who God is for yourself. And I'm not going to dictate to you what that looks like. Mm-hmm. So as an adult, we were very, my parents like allowed us to be very free with our own decisions. They raised us, and you know, my mom's kind of theory was like, God has placed me here as your mom in your life for these years. And when you become an adult and you leave the house, you have to grow up. And I'm just here to be a sounding board to help give you advice as you want it, but you have to figure life out for yourself. And
yeah,
a part of that was figuring out what my relationship with God looked like for me, for myself, because I wasn't like my mom. My mom was like a, you know, I'm going to have my devotion for an hour and I'm going to read and pray. And every day it was like the same routine. And that's just not how I connected with God. And for a while I felt guilty, like, okay, like I don't, that's just not my way. And, and I just learned like how I, you know, interact with God, whether that was like reading my Bible or if it was just me praying or spending time in worshiping and reflecting, like I found the ways that worked for me.
Yeah.
And I, you know, allowed myself to become okay with it. And I think my parents gave me that sense of, you know, understanding who I am and that I'm unique and I'm different and I'm a leader. And, you know, I just had to cultivate what that looked like for me.
Yeah. You know, it's so interesting, Faith, because I'm a Korean American, and I think in the Asian upbringing, the sort of default mode of parenting is like heavy-handed obligation, right? Like you have to do this. And there's like this communal sense of you have to do this because this is what we do as a family. Like we go to church, you have to do this, you have to do that. And there's a sense, I mean, generally speaking, I think that there's a sense in which Asian children grow up with this strong sense of obligation to family duties. And it sounds like you had a different experience with that.
Yeah. I mean, when we were a kid, there was things when it came to like church and stuff like that, that we had to do because obviously you're a kid. So
yeah. You
have to do that. But when we became an adult, the whole, like we have to be obligated to do and think, you know, or move in the same way as my parents did, that completely went away.
Yeah.
That was not there because we had to, in order to grow, you have to allow like your kids to kind of like fall a little and make their own mistakes and figure it out. And so they gave us that room. We were not perfect. We did not make all of the right decisions. My brother and I, it's just the two of us.
Okay.
But they gave us room to make our choices and our decisions and to learn from them and to support us in them and to celebrate our wins. And, if we even messed up, it was like, it's okay if you mess up and you make a mistake. We're always going to be here for you, to love you. And, you know, my mom's something she would always say is we raised you with a strong foundation in God. And, you know, my hope is that that would always be a keeper for you, you know, no matter where you are. And so I think even in seasons where, you know, my brother and I might not have been, you know, feeling close to God in those, you know, seasons of our life, we had such a strong foundation that it's not like it escaped us or left us. Like we, you know, we knew that our anchor was in God.
Yeah.
And that wasn't something that was, you know, far from us. And I think, you know, removing that as an obligation, you know, in your life kind of helps because it's not like, oh, like I'm obligated to you know, care about this. It's like, I, you know, it's more of like, I get to discover what God means to me. And so that way, whenever life happens, which it will, I get to, in my own way, know how to connect with God and it not feel like I have to connect with God because that's what my family wants me to do, or because they want me to be this kind of person. And I found that oftentimes if I had any expectation of myself, like I should be this way or that way, it was like self-imposed, but it wasn't my family putting that expectation on me.
Yeah, that's great. So you had mentioned that Houston was more diverse than Dallas.
Yes.
When you say diverse, does that mean that it had more minorities or it had a better mix of races?
You definitely like more minorities. Like my friend group in Houston is like a like first generation Mexican, first generation Indian, like you know, Black, white, you know, just all kind of like. That's just a few of our friends that are in like my immediate friend group that I can think of right now that are like, we are all very different and all of different backgrounds and have, you know, lived a lot of different life, but are all still very close. And so coming together, we learn a lot about each other and each other's cultures and families. And just like you're talking about, like, we learn what their parents might have said or roles that might have been set that are completely different than ours, but they're also, you know, their parents, you know, immigrated here to the United States. And so their experiences were different. And so we learned about their families and, you know, their parents and what that looked like. And so I just think that I got a broader perspective and picture of the beauty of diversity from the friendships that I had and created. And so I wasn't limited. And so whenever I am in a place where there isn't like a lot of diversity, it's still very weird to me because I'm used to being so surrounded by people of different ethnicities.
Yeah. You live your life now sort of on the edge of justice in society, speaking up for people and speaking out for causes. And as you look back on your childhood, are there instances where you can see the beginnings of that heart and passion as it played out for you as a child?
You know, I have always been the kind of person who leans into justice and was always that personality of the person who's like, okay, there's that one person sitting by themselves. Like, I want to go and talk to them or be their friend or help them to feel included. And my mom talks about that a lot, about how you could see those traces in my life of always being the one person who wanted to fight for the underdog or fight for the people who didn't seem to be seen. And that's where you would always find me. Either I was out helping somebody or trying to, you know, you know, be a part of something with someone and make sure they were good. Or you would find me hanging out with some kids, you know, children's church, working with like the 6 and 7 year olds. And I was maybe like 11 and reading a book to kids and just interacting with them. So I would say it's just always kind of been a part of who I am and just my personality. And it's just, you know, of course your life evolves as you grow, but I think you get a good hint of who your child is going to be in their childhood. The kind of the telltale signs are there of what their passions might be. And so for my family, they always saw that. So none of this is a surprise to them.
Growing up in Texas, what are some early memories for you of understanding the differences of race in society?
Yeah, so I became really aware of race, I would say, just because I, you know, my family, we were, my brother and I were homeschooled. I was homeschooled all the way through high school, and my brother was from second grade and up. And so we had some interesting, you know, experiences with people. Just growing up, we're just realizing that if you go to this like homeschool group outing thing, you might be the only Black family. And so, you can, you know, you easily as a kid, you kind of can like start to distinguish, you know, when you're one of the only ones. And I think I didn't know it then because I was young, but that's when I started to experience microaggressions or people saying, oh, you talk so well, or, you know, a Black person, or you're not like the other Black people. And, you know, those are kind of things that made me really aware of race. And my parents taught me, right? So we weren't taught we weren't naive about it. My parents were very open and talked to us mm-hmm. about race and how we, you know, have to maneuver the world as Black people.
Yeah.
Those are just conversations that we had as a family. So it wasn't a secret. We weren't ignorant to it. But at the same time, my parents taught us that we were not to be defined by what people might have assumed of us
yeah.
or allow ourselves to feel inferior because of the color of our skin. And that was never, it was never on the table. It was never an option, if that makes any sense. So
I see.
So we knew, but my mom was and my dad were very adamant about us holding our head up high and just being who we're called to be regardless of, you know, any opposition we faced or maybe people who, you know, might have certain thoughts about, you know, about us just because of the color of our skin.
It's interesting what you said when you said that your parents sort of helped guide you through walking through this society as a Black person, because I think as a second generation Korean American, I actually didn't have the luxury of having parents who knew how to navigate through society. In some ways, I was the one actually telling them how to navigate through this society because, I mean, they just came over here as adults and they're just figuring it out. They don't know the culture. They barely know the language, you know, those sorts of things. So those conversations that you had in your household, can you give me a glimpse of what those conversations were like?
Yeah. So my parents did they talked to us a lot about Black history. And so, you know, we would learn about different historical figures, you know, in the Black community. And the other thing is, I mean, every Black family, you know, has the talk with their kids, you know, how you're supposed to be interacting with people or interacting with the police or what people might think of you because of the color of your skin.
Yeah.
That's just normal. I mean, it's your normal everyday kind of life conversations. It's not necessarily like every single time it's like this huge sit down. It just becomes a part of your upbringing, you know, of things that you talk about that are normalized. And so those are just very normalized conversations in our household about race and what people might think of things, racism that people have experienced over time. And we just, you know, grew up knowing those things. But also, you know, I think for me, I had to learn how to navigate the world in a way where I didn't feel this pressure to assimilate, because for a while I did, because it felt like, okay, well, you're the only one. People are saying these different like microaggressions about you. They have this perception of Black people and Blackness that doesn't necessarily like represent me per se. And so, but then you realize like as a kid, I think I tried to distance myself from what white people in the community perceived my Blackness to be. Usually it was from TV or whatever, and it was negative perceptions. Yeah, and in my head, I was like, well, I want to be different. You know, I'm me, and, you know, just let me be me. But one thing I realized as I became an adult is I'm Black, and there's nothing that separates me from anyone's perception of what a Black person is. And I found that out just by the way people treated me and the way people treated me in school. And, you know, there's no amount of hard work and accolades and any of these things that you can accomplish that can save you from racism or experiencing it. And so while, yes, I was taught, yes, I had, you know, I understood that there was a world that did not, you know, believe the best about Black people, and that I was experiencing microaggressions and racist interactions with people, whether it was when I was growing up or when I got to college. But all those things helped me to realize that assimilating did nothing for me, because at the end of the day, that wasn't me allowing myself to be, you know, free and in my fullness as a Black woman to celebrate that. And also, I'm no different than what people might perceive as another Black person, I guess, like a negative stereotype or a negative stereotype about a Black woman. Like I was no different. There's no, you know, pride, I guess, like in the way to say it, there's no pride that you can have like, oh, I'm better because of yada, yada. No, there's no better. I'm Black. And
yeah.
Being Black in America means that you're treated differently for the color of your skin. And there's nothing else that, you know, you can really do about that other than obviously know who you are and be confident in that, but also just know that you're existing in a world that does not believe fully in, you know, your liberation, unfortunately.
No amount of assimilation will bring you to a point where people no longer see you as Black.
Yeah, no, which is why I learned to stop assimilating and to just be myself.
Yeah.
And if I lost friends, I lost friends because
yeah.
You didn't want me for me in the first place.
Yeah. Faith, could I ask you, when you were quote unquote trying to assimilate and when you stopped, what were some of the things that you would do or how you would act? And what were some of the things that you stopped doing or started doing once you stopped trying to assimilate?
I mean, when I was a kid, I would just try to distance myself from the negative perception of what society believes Black women to be.
What does that mean?
Angry. Society perceives Black women as angry, or they might say that, oh, well, Black women can be ghetto, or all these other just like very negative perceptions of Black women that really do not represent us in our fullness. It's very sure. like very entertainment and societal based perceptions of Black women.
Yeah.
But as a kid, obviously, I knew that that's how society perceived Black women. And so I would just try to distance myself from that. Like, oh, I'm not any of those things. Like I'm, you know, I can fit in with you all. You know, my friends used to say that I was a Black white girl, like an Oreo, Black on wow. the outside, white on the inside. And I was young and I didn't know, like, I didn't know that that wasn't a compliment. It wasn't until
right.
I was older and I got to college and I think somebody had like said something like that to me. And I was like, stop, it's not a compliment.
Right.
And I think, you know, because I experienced so many microaggressions and interactions like that between like in college, I started to find my voice. And that's when I, you know, really started to speak into it. So I stopped assimilating. And not only that, like I had made a lot more Black friends from school, not a lot, but enough, like enough where I could feel like I was in solidarity with some other people who
sure.
understood me. And I just decided to speak up. Sometimes I was just too nice. Like I was too nice and I let people talk to me and say things in a way that I just didn't want to. You know, at the time, I just didn't want to start trouble or start a fight or argue with people.
Yeah.
So I didn't speak up for myself. And then I learned that I have to speak up for myself. Otherwise, people are just going to keep saying this stuff to me.
Mm.
And I guess I'm supposed to take it. And I didn't want to take it. And I knew that I didn't deserve to take it. So I just started saying that it's wrong and I don't want to be treated that way.
So you're like in these situations where somebody's saying something or, you know, they're doing something that's getting you angry. And in your mind, you're thinking, well, I don't want to react the way that I want to react because I don't want to push this stereotype of an angry Black woman.
Sure. Yeah, to some extent. But then at the same time, I think I just kind of like was like, look, like I responded as myself. Like, but you know that anytime you're going to respond, anytime you're going to push back, somebody is going to have a negative perception of you in whatever way they want to paint that into.
Yeah.
And I just started to not care about what their perception was. I just right. wanted the record to be straight that I'm Black and I'm educated and I talk the way that I talk because my mom wanted me to enunciate my words.
Mm.
You can either deal with it or, you know, or right. leave me alone.
Right.
Like,
right.
you know, so, and I finally got to the point to where I was like, listen, me speaking properly, the way that I talk is not a perception of me trying to be white. Why can't I just be Black and smart and educated?
Right.
And why does
right.
my brilliance have to be equated with whiteness?
Mm.
And why in your mind does the fact that I talk this way mean that I'm trying to be white as if white is better?
Yeah.
And I learned enough by college and I got enough language because I was started to study social work.
Mm.
And so through that, I learned a lot and, you know, I got enough language to be able to say why it was wrong and why I did not want to be treated that way and why people shouldn't be perceived by these stereotypes. The same would go for, you know, Asian people in this country. Just because you're Asian doesn't mean that you're good at math or you're going to be a doctor or you're going to be a scientist. Like, these are all like negative perceptions and stereotypes of people that are not everyone's reality. And we have to ask ourselves, why are we continuing to perpetuate those or put those labels on people without actually getting to know who they are?
It's interesting for me because as I hear your story, your status as a Black person in America became a sense of pride and not a sense of shame. And so there was almost like a willful choice by your parents and by you to say, I'm going to be proud of this rather than have any sense of shame about this. Mm-hmm. And I would say that, you know, there's a large part of the Asian American population that I think still, even as like we grow into adulthood, there isn't a strong sense of pride that is instilled in our Asianness in here in America. And it's still a sense of shame. And I think as we get older, that shame just gets more muted or becomes more manageable. But I don't know that it's actually fully translated into pride.
You know, one thing I was thinking as you were talking about that, and you were talking about, you know, maybe not having as much of a sense of pride is, you know, as a Black person in America whose ancestors, like my people, are descendants of those who were enslaved and came over from Africa. I have no idea, you know, what tribe they were from, no idea of the language, families separated. And there's one thing that I feel like some Asian Americans have that, gosh, I wish I had, was like language and culture and a point of reference, you know, that I think is just incredibly beautiful and that I wish I had. I think that some people don't realize the insurmountable loss and grief many Black people experience here, especially when you are the descendants of those who are enslaved, because you don't have a language to refer back to. You don't know really, you know, all the way back who your ancestors were and what part of the country in Africa, what part of the continent they were from. You know, you don't know the village. You don't know any of those things. Like, it's all gone. And so when we're in this fight and we're talking about justice, it's like, this is the only home we know.
Yeah.
This is the only home we have. And when I think of my other friends whose parents have, you know, immigrated here and they've been able to keep their language and culture and those things, like, to me, like, gosh, like, that's something to have a sense of pride about.
Yeah.
Because you have so many, you know, things that connect you to understand where you come from. And that's just so beautiful to me. And so, you know, what the Black community here has done is obviously create a culture for ourselves, in America, to cling to and to be proud of. And I mean, how could I not be proud? You know, I am the descendant of people who lived through, you know, unimaginable circumstances and torture and beatings and rape, and they lived. Somebody had to live for me to be here.
Yeah, they survived.
And so here I am, you know? And so I want to make every day of my life and my breath count, because that's what my family has done for me. And I want to do that for the next generation.
So Faith, you know, in these last weeks, we've seen just a real surge in the mainstream culture outside of the Black community that is paying a lot of attention to the Black Lives Matter movement and also just the lives of Black brothers and sisters. Why do you think that that is? Why do you think that there has been this surge more recently? And how do you think we can keep that movement going?
Yeah, a surge in, so let me make sure I'm understanding, but a surge in like other ethnicities, everybody kind of coming together to care about this conversation?
Yeah, I think if I were to say it plainly, it seems like more white people and Asian people and, you know, non-Black people care more now about Black lives than they did before the George Floyd video.
Yeah.
Is it just because of the video? Do you think that this is a tipping point? And if so, why?
I do think it's a tipping point. I do think that you know, the video was a part of it. But I think it's just like so many things, like it was just like a culmination of things, right? Yeah. So first you had Ahmaud Arbery and people were like mortified, you know, seeing that, like, oh my gosh, wait, people still hate like that? I thought it was over.
Right.
Which of course many Black people were like, we've been trying to tell y'all, but nobody wanted to listen. So okay. Right, right. You know. But then the country is still reeling from that, trying to process Ahmaud's death.
Yeah.
And then you have a pandemic, so everybody's stuck in their house.
Yeah.
And the world is not fully like on all cylinders moving the way that it normally is. It's still a lot more still than usual.
Yeah.
And then you have the George Floyd video, and it's just like you're literally watching someone die on camera. And so you cannot unsee these videos, you know. And I didn't watch the Ahmaud Arbery one. I really didn't mean to watch the George Floyd one. It just, you know, somebody had sent something and I did not understand. I did not know what was going to happen in it.
Right.
And so once I saw that, I was like, oh, great. Because I really try to shield myself from those because otherwise it just stays in my head and it just gets, it's just too much. But I think with people seeing it, that has caused more people to feel outraged. Now, I do feel a way that because there's video that causes widespread outrage, because I feel like, you know, seeing so many people die over and over again, you can get really desensitized.
Right.
And so, and I don't love it. Like, I don't love seeing the videos because I also feel like it traumatizes, you know, other people in the Black community over and over again, just seeing it.
Yeah.
But I understand that, you know, when people see these things, it does kind of spur them into action a little bit in the sense of realizing that this is a problem. We still have a problem. And I think that George Floyd was a tipping point because it was just kind of like a, all right, this is still an issue. I thought it wasn't, but it's still an issue. And then a lot more, you know, Black people even were speaking up about their personal experiences that hadn't, you know. And so there's a lot of us that have had negative experiences and we're not just sitting around like talking about them all the time. Cause I mean, gosh, we would have such a long list of things to talk about, you know?
Right,
and so,
right.
But I do think that a lot more Black people were transparent and talking about what they were experiencing on their platforms and on Facebook. And it was like, you cannot escape it. Like you cannot escape what's happening. You can't escape it on the news. You can't escape it on Twitter, on Instagram, on Facebook, TikTok, you know, Snapchat, whatever like app you're on. It's everywhere. And there was no out for people to ignore what was happening. And I think that caused this groundswell already. Like Black people, I think, were on this tipping point, but it caused a more widespread outrage of something has to change.
Yeah.
It has to. Like, if it doesn't change the voices of the people will demand it, and it's not going to stop. Like, it was very clear that after George Floyd, even into where we are now, nobody is taking what is happening, sweeping it under the rug and wishing it away. People are still on the streets, still marching, still protesting, and it's not stopping. And I think that that's significant, and more people are waking up to the fact that we do have an issue. And I had people that I've known for a long time say to me, I'm sorry, I never saw it sooner.
Yeah.
And so while you would want to or hope that over the years of you talking about something, people see it, some people just don't see it. And sometimes it takes a few extreme deaths like this for people to understand why some people are saying, please, let's have police reform, right? Like I interned for the Houston Police Department for my master's degree internship and in their victim services unit, because I wanted to understand what it was like to be around police officers and the police force and all of that stuff. And all the people in there would say, like, there's some great people that work here, some awesome officers, and there's some corrupt ones. And we know who they are, but they don't turn each other in because, you know, they have their little code. Mm-hmm. And so we can acknowledge the tensions that exist, but we can also acknowledge that, you know, the police force does get a ton of funding and all of this stuff. And there's other areas. And as a social worker, I know this from working in these environments, like there's other places that also could use more funding to help in the community. And we have to look at the history of policing. We have to look at the fact that the police force as we know it now was birthed out of patrols for enslaved people and trying to recapture them and sending them, you know, to wow. Back to their, you know, quote unquote masters. And so it's yeah. just like, I think that, you know, we have to be mindful of the history of where things, you know, derived from and why we are where we are today. So there were human beings who were torturing and enslaving other human beings.
Yeah.
They created a group of people to capture them and make sure that they didn't escape. And so then over time that morphed into the police force that we have today. So if we never acknowledge the history of where things are derived from and why we are where we are today and do our part, right, as a country to repair and to repent, to fix what's broken, then it's just going to be like we're just putting a Band-Aid on a wound that has never healed because right. we've never actually, you know, done what needs to be done for there to be true healing and repair in this country.
Wow. For a Black person who's seeing the rest of society, white people, Asian people, finally wake up to this reality, you would have complete liberty to be able to just write us off and say, we've been saying this for years, and now you suddenly want to listen because it's convenient for you, it's expedient for you, or whatever. But you've really stepped into this to really generously help lead people through their discovery of this. Even though this is not new for you, this may be new for a lot of other people, but you've just really, you know, through Instagram and the things that you've been posting, your podcast, you have just really stepped in to help lead people through that journey. I don't know what the question is, but I guess it must be exhausting.
You know, in some ways it is exhausting, and then in others it's energizing. I feel like I'm very much so called to this work. I think
okay.
that there's a difference when you're like called to the work that you're doing. And, you know, if you're not a believer or a faith person, called is almost just kind of like what you feel it is you're putting, you are put on this earth to do, right? I feel yeah. like this is a piece of what I'm supposed to be doing on this earth. And so it doesn't feel overwhelming. It just feels like this is what I'm supposed to do. And I have just learned the ways to find rest. And there's of course moments of frustration, moments where you get tired and all of that, because I'm a human being and that's all very normal, but I don't feel overwhelmed by any of it because I feel very fortunate that I get to help people. And I still remind people to do their work, right? So there's plenty of DMs that I get. I don't answer them all. I can't, first of all. Right. But second of all, I mean, you have to do your work. I can't just solely be the only, you know, voice you're listening to. There's podcasts right. to listen to. There's documentaries. There's books to read. And
yeah.
and I like to give people books to read and then say, let's have a conversation after you've read something. Because the person that I'm talking to right now and the perceptions you have right now are going to be different once you learn something.
Yeah.
And I can't have a productive conversation with somebody who's just going to talk to me based on what they think they know from history, the same history all of us learned. Uh-huh. We have to educate ourselves beyond what we learned because we understand that what we did learn was whitewashed history.
Yeah.
But what I will say is I've appreciated the solidarity from the Asian community. I have some friends that are Korean and they've been using their platform to really educate other Asian people sure. and talk about why Black Lives Matter and why it's important. And I have been so encouraged by that. And I think the other thing for, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, I might be making the wrong assumption, but I think just with what Asian Americans have started to experience in this, especially this year with hostility towards Asian Americans sure. and the racism yeah. that has been happening to the Asian American mm-hmm. community, I think that helped add a level of empathy for the Black community in a way that maybe we didn't have before.
I think you're exactly right. I think if I were to be as bold on this podcast to say publicly, I think Asian Americans in many ways have chosen the side of privilege as we've navigated society. And I think we have carved out a nice little suburban niche in this privileged society and say, we can fly under the radar and we can assimilate and we can be fine. And we lived many, many years like that. And then COVID happens and our president calls it the Kung Flu. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden people start looking at Asian people different. And I've always been thinking like we are one bomb away from North Korea for everybody to look at Korean people differently. Like that's all it would take. And, you know, all it actually took was a virus from China. And so now I think everybody was like, oh, well, the thread that I am hanging on in this society is so fragile and so thin. And it, in some ways, I think the way that the anti-Asian racism was escalating through the coronavirus, mm-hmm. and then when the awakening of society with George Floyd and Black Lives Matter, I think you're right. I think that there was just a galvanizing of the Asian American community to say, you know what? It was the veil of privilege was being pulled back during this coronavirus outbreak, and then I think when we were forced to really choose a side mm-hmm. in May with this George Floyd situation, I think you're seeing more and more Asian Americans say, it's actually the decision that you made as a young child to say, no matter how much I try and assimilate, I will never not be seen as Black. Mm-hmm. And Asian people are saying, no matter how well I can assimilate, even for years I can assimilate, I will never not be seen as Asian in this society.
Right, right. Exactly. Mm. That is exactly it. I've been encouraged to see more Asian American people putting words to that, because I think that, you know, some of these same experiences have existed once again, just like Black people, but it hasn't been widespread, like people talking about it.
Yeah.
And I think that's what I appreciated when all this stuff was going on with, you know, a lot of the, you know, hatred that Asian Americans were seeing. Like I was seeing people post more about, hey, this was has been my experience.
Yeah.
And the more people see that, the more it's like, yes, it becomes real for people. And I love, like, one of my friends, she is half Filipino, and she was talking about how I was saying something to her, and I said, you are a woman of color, and I'm excited to see what happens in your life. And she was just like, I never identified myself as a woman of color.
Wow.
And because she was half white, but I'm like, but you are. And, yeah. And that started like a trajectory in her head about her identity and, you know, like kind of like finding her place. And, you know, when I was talking to her about like, that's something to be proud of.
Yeah.
And proud of your heritage and all of those things. And so my hope when I see it is that more Asian Americans in this country are proud of their heritage,
yeah.
proud of their language and home country and who they are. Mm. And that, you know, they don't have to assimilate. None of us have to accept that whiteness makes us better
right.
or more susceptible in society, like who we are, who God designed us to be, because we're made in the image of God. Who we are is acceptable and wonderful and to be celebrated and to be embraced for who we are. And there is no amount of things that we can do that we feel are acceptable, so to speak,
yeah.
Societally acceptable, that, you know, can take away from our identity when we embrace it. There's so much power in us embracing who we are
right.
and choosing not to assimilate ourselves and accept the status quo or accept doing things like everyone else, so that way we cannot be seen for who we are and for our culture and heritage. So I'm always encouraged when I see people embracing their cultures and their heritage. And I'm like, it's so important. And especially because there's so much that I've lost as a Black person. Mm. When I see other people who have connection to language and culture and all those things, I'm like, embrace it.
Yeah.
Celebrate it. Keep it, because pass it on to your kids, you know, because it's so important and the world needs that. We need
yeah.
the diversity. We need the beautiful expansion and expression of language and culture, because to me, it's also an expression of the fullness of God.
Embrace embracing our own culture and heritage, and embracing the culture and heritage of others. Faith's parents taught her that in the home and around the dinner table, and now she's using her life and her platform to teach others about the beauty and celebration of diversity. Now you can see why Faith is one of the voices to listen to. You can find her on Instagram at FaithB, and remember, that's Faith with two T's. And you should listen and subscribe to the Melanated Faith podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're at it, if you haven't subscribed, rated, and reviewed The Pursuit on iTunes, well, then I'm not even sure what you're doing with your life. You can find us on social at The Pursuit Cast, and you can find me on social at richardl.ee. Now, as we go, remember, you may not know where your journey ends, but you can find God all along the path.
Plus, Jesus didn't speak English anyway. There's that.